Hello, everybody, and welcome to John and Maxwell Survivor Talk. I'm John Gilpatrick.
And I'm Maxwell Haddad.
And we are coming to you. This is our second episode. Thanks to everyone who listened to the first episode of the podcast. And we are going to be recapping episode 5 of Survivor Cambodia Second Chance. And we're recording this the day after the episode aired. So last night we said goodbye to the Chicago Cubs. Like what I did there?
I did, and I'm very happy about it.
Congratulations.
Not to disparage any Cubs fans, I sympathize, but I've been a Mets fan for a long time, and we have suffered enough to feel that we deserve to be in the World Series after 15 years.
I think that's fair, and I think that the Cubs don't have to worry too much. I don't think at least a World Series appearance is too far away.
I agree. I think they're a really good team, and they're going to do well next season.
So in addition to the baseball, obviously, we're going to be talking about Survivor, and we also said goodbye last night to Monica Padilla, something that we sort of forecasted a little bit last week, right?
It was discussed as a possibility, and although we said goodbye to Monica Padilla, we also kind of said hello to Monica Padilla, because this was just about the only screen time she's gotten all season.
Yeah, which is too bad. Sort of like the whole, you know, I thought this was a good episode of the show, and it really kind of kicked into gear towards the end. I think the vote will give us a lot to talk about. But overall, I think it was probably my least favorite episode because it sort of felt like a foregone conclusion from the start. Did you feel similarly?
A little bit. I mean, when they focus so much on the clam fight between Monica and Kimmy, I thought it was sort of suggesting that that is the tribe that will end up at Tribal Council and that that fight would become an important factor into the decision as to who's going home. That's not the sort of scene they would normally show unless it had an impact on the actual game itself.
Yeah, I totally agree. And my wife was, sort of half watching the episode with me while she was doing other things. And she saw in the beginning, like, these two characters who haven't been featured at all on the season fighting about clams at the beginning of the episode. And she, like, you know, is not one to, like, pay attention to the edit or anything like that. But she, as soon as that scene was done, she said, oh, one of those two's going home.
I think that was kind of a foregone conclusion at that point. But what I find interesting is traveling back throughout the years of Survivor to Kimmy Kappenberg's first appearance. She was most noted for a fight she had over a chicken and not wanting to kill it and not wanting to eat it because she was a vegetarian. So can we assume that over time she is switched from a vegetarian to a pescatarian?
That's a great question. Another one that was discussed in the Gilpatrick household last night. And I'll do one even better traveling back to Survivor, the Australian Outback. If you remember that fight between Kimmy and Alicia Calloway, Kimmy's whole, the premise of her argument was not that we shouldn't kill this chicken because that's cruel. Her argument was we should not kill this chicken because it's important to take what little protein we have and sort of spread it out throughout this 39-day journey, if you will. And Alicia so eloquently said that, no, we need to be having protein every day, and I will always be wagging my finger in your face. So do you think there was anything with that experience that sort of changed Kimmy's opinion of maybe we should just eat all the food we have?
It's possible that, you know, you have to assume that these players, because they kind of had more advanced notice than players in the past might have had because of the vote and whatnot, sort of did their homework. And maybe she looked back to that moment and with age and more maturity realized that maybe she wasn't 100% right or took a lesson from that. That's possible. But I think a clam and a chicken are a different situation because chickens can, some of them can lay eggs. Yeah. And those eggs can sustain you over time. Whereas these clams, they're going to float away and you may lose them a couple days later.
I think the thing about whether or not to eat the food that you have was sort of settled a couple seasons ago in San Juan del Sur when you had the, I think Hunapu tribe, is that right? And they were, you know, sort of infamous in their gluttony, where they went ahead and they ate all the rice they had without rationing whatsoever. And by day 10, they were out, and they had to sort of go to Jeff Probst sheepishly and say, like, hey, can we have some more food, please?
They sort of turned Survivor into Let's Make a Deal.
Yeah, which was really funny at the time.
It happened a couple times that season, too.
It did, like, with their Flint also. And
which is partly why that season got the reputation of people who didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
Maybe mistakenly, but...
But what's sort of interesting is this is actually the first season of Survivor that was filmed since that season aired. And so we never really got to see the should you eat, should you conserve food debate play out in a post-San Juan del Sur world. And so I sort of wondered if that would be something that ever came up where a tribe just said, especially a tribe that had a San Juan del Sur contestant on it, where they said, hey, like, let's just eat the food. Jeff will come and give us more. Trust me. It happened. And we didn't really get that, but it made me sort of wonder, like, how much San Juan del Sur Monica washed because she was so concerned about not eating the clams that were in front of them.
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, it's a hypothetical. If I were to ever play the game, what I would do. I feel like you should eat what you have when you have it because it may not be there tomorrow.
Yeah, and then you also have the sort of thing that's like, well, obviously the more protein we have, the better we can do in the challenges. Not necessarily. Oh, well, that's true.
If you look to last week, Angkor got a big feast. And in some cases, when you don't eat for a long time and then you do eat, it could actually sort of wreck your stomach and give you unfortunate side effects that could hinder your performance in challenges.
That's definitely true.
I think there's like a happy medium you can find between eating just enough, but not too much where you're making yourself sick.
I do think that the food that they won in the reward challenge was sort of sausage and other things that their systems probably weren't at all used to after, you know, a week or so.
True.
Versus the giant clams that they've been eating. But, I mean, your point's well taken. And ultimately, I don't think that this argument about clams probably led whatsoever to Monica's demise. I think that was something that do you really? Okay.
I 100% think Kimmy Kappenberg was acting on emotion and her annoyance with Monica and she manipulated the other guys who voted with her to get her out simply because of the fight.
Yeah, she does. I mean, I think that we can say that the person who most directly led to Monica's expulsion from the game was Kimmy.
I think it was a terrible move.
Yeah, so do I. Okay, let's jump right into it then, because I totally agree.
For a variety of reasons, you know, a swap or a merge could be pending, and the four of them that were together previously, by voting out someone, it could show the other members of their previous tribe that they could be reuniting with, that there's no loyalty there.
Right.
On top of that, I think Monica could have been more of an asset pre-merge than, say, Kelly or Spencer. And Spencer, I mean, if it was me, I would have gotten Spencer out first chance because he's such a threat.
It seemed really obvious to me that was the best thing to do. And you're debating, you're debating between these three potential boots. And you have one who, like, really, really wants to be there desperately, is, won three immunity challenges on his season, is, like, a very sort of socially adept player, and obviously has a very sharp mind for the game, especially if I'm somebody like Steven. And I know, like, they seem like they'd be good allies, but I also wonder if, like, there's sort of like there could be a competition between the two once you get into like a post-merge scenario.
Absolutely. If I'm Steven Fishback, Spencer's the first person I want to get out because I think in many ways they sort of fill the same slot.
Yeah.
And although Spencer is obviously more athletically talented than Steven is.
We'll get to that too.
Yeah. It didn't seem like a smart move to me. It was played on emotion. It was all because of Kimmy's manipulation. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I feel like it's something that could end up. I don't know if it'll hurt, say, Jeremy, but I definitely think it could hurt Kimmy down the line.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Monica's, you know, feeble sort of attempts to make a women's alliance, like, I think the whole thing was probably taken completely out of context on Kimmy's part, and she just sort of used that as ammunition to go to Steven and Jeremy, because
I
assumed that Monica's desire to do that was meant going after Spencer and not going after Steven or Jeremy,
right.
And that once we got rid of Spencer, then sure, let's get rid of Kelly next, right?
Which was honestly, from a pure gameplay perspective, the right move, is getting rid of Spencer.
Yeah, it's kind of too bad that she went home through very little fault of her own.
Well,
I'd argue. Go ahead.
She did say when they lost to the challenge that she didn't mind that they were going to tribal.
That was not good.
Which was not the right thing to say. So I wouldn't say it's entirely not her fault, but I see what you're getting at, and it was not anything really to do with her gameplay that caused her to go. It was more about her personality. Mm-hmm. And when you compare that to the fact that Abby is still standing strong,
yeah.
This is kind of like what you would have expected to happen with Abby already happened to Monica.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I would say about Monica is that she did things that could have put her in a position to go home, but I don't think any of those actual things led to her going home.
I'll take that. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's just sort of weird. Like the whole Monica arc that really began and ended in this episode struck me as a little strange and kind of artificial because of the fact that we hadn't seen her and like we needed to catch up.
Right. It was a true blindside, though, which doesn't really happen so much anymore.
Yeah.
They're always throwing up hashtag blindside on the screen, and I would argue that maybe only 2 out of 10 of hashtag blindsides are legitimate blindsides.
Yeah.
It was a blindside not only because Monica had no clue, but because half of the tribe had no clue. Spencer and Kelly were as shocked as Monica was.
Yeah, which was great. And like
makes for great TV, but it doesn't necessarily inspire tribe unity, because now not only have you cut someone who was aligned with you simply because you came from the same tribe, but now you lied to the other two people on your tribe, and 3 versus 2, the numbers are dwindling, and it's easy for them to flip it around at this point.
Yeah, I guess maybe they were probably banking on the fact that because we were forcing Spencer and Kelly to vote for the other person, that they wouldn't so easily come back to each other. And afterward,
yeah, but I don't know.
It was really funny after the votes were read, and Monica was, you know, getting her torch snuffed, and Kelly Wigglesworth sort of grabbed Spencer's hand.
Yeah,
and like, oh, I guess we're still here. Good job.
I thought it was funny, but also kind of sweet.
It was sweet, but it just kind of made me laugh.
You know, and once again, too, we see the theme of old school versus new school, which they're really. Sort of crafting this whole season out of.
Yeah, they've been hammering it home, and I actually don't mind it so much because I think it's been sort of playing out in really interesting ways, because
it almost makes me wish that they had purposefully crafted the season so that there were 10 people from seasons 1 through 15 and 10 from 15 through 30.
That would have been awesome.
Something like that, so you had... Because I feel like there's more new school than old school overall. So if there's more of a balance, then you could really see that playing out.
Especially if you have the tribes divided that way for 2 episodes and let them
right.
play right. in a way that they're more accustomed to, and then shake it up and say, like, all right, like, figure this out now, guys.
Yeah. But it's, you know, maybe they liked it this time and they'll do it again in the future.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
There's definitely lots of old school people I wouldn't mind seeing again, so that's fine.
A few of whom almost made it on this season and didn't.
Indeed they did. So let's roll back to the beginning of the episode, if we can, and talk about a little bit of what's going on at Angkor, the new 4-person tribe that, you know, they can now win challenges and compete, and they seem like they're a fairly... united group with one very boisterous exception.
I don't know. This tribe is just baffling to me. how they are succeeding to the extent that they are or did, I just don't get it.
I think that just represents like a total overdue breakdown on Bayon.
Yeah. It has to happen at some point. These tribes that were staying strong, eventually something has to go wrong.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I mean, it seemed like it was probably building to this episode where Bayon lost both challenges and was sort of a at camp train wreck. But Angkor, I mean, Angkor still hasn't really totally gotten it together. They just performed in these two challenges. And, you started out the episode after the tribal council and Wu was thanking everybody for keeping him around and they're, talking about Jeff. And, you know, how he got voted off. And you had this, like, bizarre line from Andrew Savage. Did you catch that?
I did.
Yeah, he says about Jeff, he's in a better place.
I don't know what he's talking about.
That was the weirdest thing.
Jeff Varner is still alive. Ponderosa, a pre-jury Ponderosa, is not a better place than being in a game where you could win $1 million.
No.
It's just more... stuff from Andrew Savage that unfortunately is just not making me care for him in this game. Again, I'm sure he's a good lawyer and a nice person outside of this game, but
he's got a hot wife.
Got a hot wife that he cries about. He's just playing this like white knight, you know, all American persona that's rubbing me the wrong way. He's laying it on too thick.
Yeah, it's just so, like, so serious, and
and he's trying to be so noble.
It's as if, like, this game really is, like, to him, sort of life and death, and he talks so much about how this has haunted him for 12 years in the preseason and since Pearl Islands, and I think this sort of reinforced it, but it was just, like, I thought it was very off-putting.
Look, I think it's clear that what happened in Pearl Islands had some significant psychological damage to him.
Yeah.
When he says that it's haunted him, I believe it.
Yeah.
Like, I picture him waking up with the dream sweats, picturing Lil, you know, yelling in his face that I got farther than you. But you contrast that, and you contrast his, quote, sob story from a couple episodes ago where he's talking about his wife, to the story Wu tells.
Yes, so that was the next thing I wanted to talk about.
to me, was a far more resonant story.
Yeah.
And when Wu was in his confessional and he was tearing up, I was moved. I felt that it was genuine. I identified with the story because I think we all understand what it's like to have a family member with health problems.
Sure.
And then you kind of have Andrew and Abby almost rolling their eyes at the story.
Yeah, Andrew's reaction was sort of, like, how about that?
That's a good story, Wu.
Have I told you about my hot wife yet?
Yeah, I just don't get it. It's like, Wu showed pretty much no emotion his first time out, and now he's, like, connecting with these people, and they're not having it.
Yeah, and I really like Wu. I liked him tonight, and just in general, I think he's very compelling on camera.
Yeah, I don't think he's good at the game of Survivor, but he's fun. He's fun to watch. He's sort of like an open book of a person. The moment for me that sold me on Wu is in his first season when they won the reward challenge to go and give the backpacks and toys to the school, and he did his little performance.
Yeah, that was great.
He just has such a like joie de vivre, you know, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
that is kind of infectious, but Abby and Andrew are such sourpusses that they're just like, screw you, Wu.
Yeah, I mean, Andrew's reaction was odd, I found, but Abby's was sort of repellent. And, you know, she sort of starts going around to Tasha. You know, we saw her in a conversation with Tasha. And I think Tasha seemed like she was just sort of, you know, placating Abby, as she's proven herself very good at. But she's talking about, well, I don't know what Wu is doing. What is he trying to do? Get sympathy from you? And she's like, well, I had my tendon replaced and like all these other, like, oh, and my aunt died and like trying to, I don't know. It's just very strange and just, you know, Abby can be obviously very difficult to live with, as everyone on the season so far has said.
Yes.
As a television character, she's good for the show. She's very funny and kind of she stirs the pot. But every once in a while, she'll sort of pull something like this, and I'm just sort of like, oh, I wish you'd just go home now.
Yeah, as opposed to certain other troublemakers who are fun television, I don't necessarily think Abby is fun television.
Mm.
To a point. Some of the things she does are just like, haha, and then when what she was saying here about Wu was just like, yeah, grow up.
Yeah, it that was just...
It was childish.
Yeah, it was. It was a little...
And I felt bad for Wu because obviously these people don't hear what other people are saying in the confessionals until the episode airs.
Yeah.
So imagine being Wu sitting at home watching this episode, maybe with your family,
right.
Maybe with your mother who got a heart transplant, who you're just, you know, telling 10 million people on TV about while crying, and then they cut to Abby, who's like, hey, manipulating me, and I don't buy it, and blah, blah, blah. It's just like, that's not, I don't know, it was unbecoming.
Let's hope that, you know, she fired off a text message or something and apologized.
I don't think that's what Abby would do. Maybe. I mean, it's possible. I hope so.
Do you want to talk about, is there anything to talk about in the reward challenge this week? I thought it was kind of a uneventful challenge.
The reward challenge was, the reward challenge was the rolling?
Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing I want to talk about is you have to have a strong constitution to get in one of those tubes and get rolled. I would throw up.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to do that either.
It was a fine challenge, it was big in scale, lots of rolling, but not too much to talk about, I don't think.
I didn't remember it from the first time they played it, which I guess was on Blood versus Water, but we had the Takeo tribe came in first. Keith is master of the balls.
Everybody's working on the balls now. It's another Jeff Probst double entendre that made my household giggle.
Oh, it's great, yeah.
He's like, gotta be saying these things on purpose. He has to be.
Yeah,
you can't be that clueless.
It was good. It was fun.
It was great.
The Takeo tribe won. First place, they got like a comfort item kit and a tarp and chairs, and then they also got like orange juice and snacks or something at camp, which was kind of funny. And so that was the
I would have been psyched about that orange juice.
Yeah, that would have been great.
I mean, water is great, but I'm a type of person that like enjoys my like juices and sodas on occasion, and I feel like I would miss that almost more than food. Like
and
orange juice has great vitamins in it that can like refresh your system better than a sausage can.
Yeah, definitely.
Like here's some ground meat, or here's a refreshing glass of fresh juice. I'll take the juice.
I'm taking the juice too, I think.
Yeah.
So they went back to camp and were enjoying their rewards, and everyone's happy on this tribe. And then you had Terry, I guess, decide, well, I'm going to go fishing. And while he's in the water, everybody else says, we're the final five.
Yeah.
He's gone next.
And to Kelly Wentworth's credit, she had already sort of laid the groundwork for throwing him under the bus last week.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about that. Like, where do you think the Terry needs to go next really came from? Was it Kelly Wentworth's work that they sort of set up in the previous episode, or something we didn't see? Do you think that maybe Joe is saying that, like, we should get Terry out because he might be a threat to me in individual immunity challenges later?
I think that's part of it. I think Joe is smart in realizing, even though he's, you know, much older than he was, that Terry is still clearly a very physically impressive competitor. And Joe is only going to get far in this game if he can win post-merge challenges. I also think it's partly that they're playing a little smarter than Bayon did and recognizing we need to stick with the four of us who came from another tribe prior. And then there's two others. And who's sitting with us? Kelly. And Kelly's a girl. And she didn't make that much of an impression on her first season versus Terry. So let's keep her because she's less of a threat versus Terry.
Yeah, it's interesting. Who do you think out of this five is kind of sitting best? You know, let's pretend that this actually is the final five. Like, Who does that work for?
Sierra.
Yeah.
I think it works really well for Sierra. And funnily enough, I think it works kind of well for Cass.
Yeah.
You know, because thus far, and I think we touched on this in our last episode, she's playing almost a 180 game from her first time, and she's forging bonds that at least yet she hasn't pulled out the chaos. But my inclination is Sierra, and Keith to an extent too, because he's going to do well in challenges. He's just a super chill, likable guy, and it's nice to see him bonding with people. But if I can say one thing a little bit out of the context of the episode itself, Keith said that, you know, in my first season, no one wanted to align with me. And Josh Canfield was tweeting up a storm saying, "That is a lie, Keith. I offered you an alliance and you turned me down."
Oh, boy.
So I just thought that was funny that Keith is maybe not either remembering or telling us the truth, but
I don't think he remembers.
Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, going back to what you said about Cass, I think if you had to, if you asked me sort of who has been playing the best so far this season out of everyone who's left, I mean, she's in the conversation, which is crazy.
Which is crazy because she played such a terrible, terrible game the first. Well, she played. I struggle when I say things like that because if you get pretty far in the game, you have to have done something right.
Yeah.
But she did. She made so many bad, boneheaded moves the first time that she became a goat almost.
Yeah.
A goat that the winner of the final challenge opted to not take. But, you know. I'm pretty sure Tony would have taken Cass had he won the final challenge.
Yeah, I think so.
I think Spencer, I think anybody would have taken Cass.
Given
the choice. But she's playing, there's a lot to be said for being able to change your game. And I think Spencer is trying very hard to change his mistakes, not to as much success as Cass is, which is surprising.
I think Spencer talks really well about changing. But
yes.
He never actually follows through on it. And I'm not sure if that's like a problem, like he's not aware of that, if he thinks he is, or if he can't help himself. And to his credit, like in the episode, in the last episode, he said that like it's against my better judgment to just be cool and let this lie and trust what they said, but that's kind of what I have to do right now.
He's 23 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not that significantly older than him, but that's young, you know, compared to someone in their 40s or 50s. You have a lot to learn when you're still 23. And I think that has a lot to do with it. It's very hard when you're that young to change things that are inherent in you. And he's obviously anxious and he calculates everything. And although we've seen him bonding here and there, I didn't necessarily feel that bonding with people was his problem the first time. I think it was his erratic nature.
Yeah. Which, yeah.
But good for Cass.
Yeah, good for Cass, I'd say.
Her self-help books are helping.
Yeah. Cass is in the conversation of, you know, sort of best overall gameplay so far.
And as long as we're talking about social media responses, Trish Kagayan, who hated Cass, wrote to Cass that she loves how she's been playing this season and thinks that if they had played, she had played like this, that they would have been best friends.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
good for Trish.
Yeah, seriously.
way to step up and be the bigger woman.
What did Cass say anything back?
She said something like, "Look who's on my side now," like something a little quippy.
Well, let's pretend that was just nice and playful.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the immunity challenge.
Yeah.
Do you want to take this one?
this is a really fun challenge.
Yeah, it was great.
I love the obstacle course. It's, like I said, it's big in scale. I like it when they have to climb things.
Yeah, I like that it was sort of like you need to shoot and like then the next person needs to go.
Right. It kept the pace up. It was so almost kind of like a relay race. and Joe is still somehow like a howler monkey. Like the way he moves up those ladders is like he's flying. But our friend Stephen Fishback, who unfortunately has this kind of, I feel like anytime he's on screen this season, Yakety Sax should be playing a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is somewhat endearing and also somewhat unfortunate because it's kind of flipping his reputation for being the strategic mastermind. Like, I don't recall him being this silly his first time out. And I don't know if that's just because they cut all that stuff out because of how far he made it or what. But, he gets up there. He doesn't really stumble on his way up the obstacle course. And he gets to the slingshot and he shoots and hits another team's target, which Jeff says that counts.
Jeff was so excited.
He was so, to Steven's credit, he kind of like laughed about it. And I don't think anyone was that upset.
But, I don't think so either.
You know, it was kind of ridiculous. And Jeff said in an interview today that when they were doing rehearsal, they said they thought it was impossible for any of them to hit another team's target.
Yeah, and so, I saw that interview that was on Entertainment Weekly.
Right.
And not only that, but in fact, when he was walking through the challenge with the contestants, Steven asked him what would happen if we hit one of the other targets.
It became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Look, and hey, he did the he did what Jeff Probst thought was impossible. So
you can hang his hat on that.
Yeah,
I've watched the Vine of it at least like 20 times today.
It's so funny.
Yeah, because he really is like just he pulls it back and then sort of just turns very abruptly to the left, and it's like he's aiming right at the yellow ones.
I don't know if he like got distracted by a squirrel in a tree or something, but
oh, I don't know. It was really funny. There was some talk about whether the Bion tribe was at a disadvantage in this challenge because they were in the middle.
That's interesting.
Because they could have shot it in either direction and hit another team's target. And my thought on that was, yes, that's true. But at the same time, you could have either tribe hitting your targets.
That's also true.
So I think it probably evened out.
Yeah. I don't know if they even considered that because, like Jeff said, they didn't even consider that as a possibility.
Sure. I mean,
when they designed the challenge.
It seemed like that team was doomed from the start when they decided to sit Jeremy out.
I don't know why they made that decision.
It's really weird.
Spencer's a very good competitor, and he proved to be better at skee ball than Jeremy.
Yeah.
In the reward challenge, even though they couldn't do well enough to win. I don't know.
I mean, all due respect to Kimmy, but she competed in the reward challenge and could have sat out in the immunity challenge, but she played and Jeremy sat, which struck me as very strange.
They almost self-sabotaged, I don't know.
Well, and if you listen to some of the Monica Padilla exit interviews, she suggests that maybe there was talk about throwing a challenge.
I mean, if there was, they certainly didn't, even imply that on the episode itself.
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
The difference between Survivor and Big Brother, I don't know if you watch Big Brother at all.
I follow it.
But the biggest difference, obviously, is for the viewers, there's so much that happens in Survivor that we don't know about.
Right.
We're seeing a crafted narrative. And with Big Brother, if you watch the feeds, even though no one can watch them all day, every day, you can go back and you have websites and reporting on what happens. You get a bigger picture over everything that's happening. So it's entirely possible, Jeremy and Steven went into the woods somewhere and said, hey, let's throw it and cut the fat a little bit. And we didn't see that. I don't know.
That might just be speculation. And
sure.
It could be, afterwards when you're sitting at Ponderosa thinking, what did I do wrong? And you think back to the challenge,
right.
Say, like, Jeremy sat out. That was weird. Like, huh.
But look, if you're going to throw it as this tribe, you're not going to throw it to get rid of Monica. You're going to throw it to get rid of Kelly or Spencer.
Yeah, you would think Spencer is probably, prime candidate number one for that.
The funny thing is that Jeremy and Spencer have this bond going on that could play out, and maybe they could go pretty far together.
It seems like Jeremy has that with both Steven and Spencer separately.
Right, and he's going to have to pick one. Like, which nerd do you want to take with you?
Which one do you want to be the Steven to your JT, the actual Steven or Spencer?
Right, exactly right.
But it's weird that we've seen both of those relationships develop, but not really one between Spencer and Steven.
I think that might be intentional on both of their parts because I think they're aware of the place they fill and their reputations. And I think if other people saw them forming a tight bond, they would want to cut it quick.
Yeah.
Because a team up of Steven and Spencer could be very strong and they could strategize well together. So maybe they have like an unspoken bond that they're just not making public.
I totally agree that it's not in their interest to make that plain to everybody else on the show. You know, I'm surprised that they haven't found time to sneak away and go collect some wood or something like that, and that it wasn't shown to us, but it doesn't mean it hasn't happened.
It could have happened and they didn't show it, or it could have happened and maybe the cameras weren't on.
Sure.
You know, again, Big Brother, the cameras are always on because they're not operated, but in Survivor, every camera is operated by a human being, and it can't be everywhere at once. I can't imagine that they have a camera for every person. And if someone is off doing something really exciting and Spencer and Steven are off talking about, I don't know, Settlers of Catan in the woods, why would the camera be there?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, when you think about sort of the production of the show. This is getting a little meta, but like when they're on three separate beaches, the resources are stretched more thinly, you know?
Yeah.
And so you might not have the same coverage, like you allude to, that you might in a two-tribe or a one-tribe format.
That's a very good point.
So, you know, we talked a lot about everything post-immunity challenge with the decision to get rid of Monica and Spencer and Kelly being in the mix as well. What one thing I want to ask you is, you know, we sort of had this, we had a 3-2-1 vote, right? Sort of like a famous Survivor maneuver that was first initiated by Suri Fields in Survivor Panama.
Right.
You can't see this, but I have in my notes about trying a Suri Fields TM 3-2-1 vote. all rights reserved to Suri Fields for the 3-2-1 references.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's any chance they voted the way they did just because somebody like Steven wanted to do a 3-2-1 vote?
That seems like something Steven would love.
Yeah.
I don't know. that would be pure speculation. I loved it. I thought it was fun. Maybe.
I don't know.
Possible.
Are there any other? So I just talked about like Suri trademarked the 3-2-1. Are there any other like big famous Survivor moves that we can like specifically credit to one previous cast member?
I don't know about specific moves. Definitely styles of gameplay.
Yeah, you have the Sandra. You know
exactly. I was getting the Sandra, the Rob, Russell that people have taken and sort of adapted to fit their personality a little bit. But I mean, you wouldn't have a Fishback or a Spencer if not for Rob Sesternino.
Yeah, definitely.
And you wouldn't have Tony Blachos without Russell Hance. So
right.
I don't know.
I sort of thought of the 3-2-1 as like Suri was a professional wrestler and that's like her finishing move.
Suri's awesome.
She's the best.
Yeah, she's great.
Is there anything else that like we haven't covered from this episode? I think we hit all the major points.
I think now we kind of just look to the future and I feel like this would be the right time in terms of the episodes to swap again if they're going to swap again. It's too early for a merge, but I could definitely see him swapping again next week.
Yeah, I think that, you know, on Rob Has a Podcast last week, he talked about how he felt like it was time to retire the Angkor tribe and just, you know, reshuffle and put them back at Bayon and Takeo.
Yeah.
And I think that they sort of lucked out that they didn't do it this week and that took that Angkor didn't lose again.
Yeah.
But they might not push their luck again.
probably not. I think it's a fair bet to say that they go back to two tribes.
Yeah, if they don't do it this week, then they might next week because, like, traditionally in the past few seasons that have 18 castaways, you have at 14 a shakeup.
Right.
So if it's not, I think, like, I really hope they do it this week because I think it would be best for the show. But if they don't, then I think you're definitely looking at one the following week.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't know exactly how that's going to look, if they're going to actually shake up the tribes or if maybe they'll do something like they did on Survivor All-Stars, which was whoever loses this immunity challenge is going to get absorbed by the other tribes.
I feel like, for fairness, they'll just draw buffs again.
Oh, boy. Could you imagine?
It would be, you know, when you I think, personally, I love seeing people who have played before. But when you have a cast of people who have played before, as much as you can do to screw with the status quo, the better it is for the you know, entertainment value of the show itself.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I do think it's something that the show is doing more this season than they ever really have before. Assuming we're right, you know, assuming that they're going to do something imminently.
The first time they did All-Stars, it was the first time. So they were feeling
it.
Oh,
sure, yeah.
The second time we had a full cast of returnees, it was heroes versus villains, and that was enough of a hook where you didn't have to shake anything up. You kept the lines drawn down the middle, heroes, villains, and then you merged. This time, the mix of people is so bizarre, and that the more you can screw with them, the more fun it is for me.
That's fair.
You know, not to the point where you're like directly affecting their games in any way, but just shaking up the tri makeups and stuff like that is fun.
Yeah, I just put myself in like their shoes, and I don't think that there would be a time out there where I was as nervous as if when, you know, Jeff said drop your buffs.
Oh yeah, especially for the second time in as many weeks.
It's so random, like. Just right. Anything can happen. You could be playing a flawless game. We just talked about Cass is doing phenomenally, and Cass could end up on a tribe with, you know, she could end up on a tribe with all former Kageyan people.
Right. If it's Wu, Spencer, Tasha, and Cass all on one tribe, you better believe those three are going to try and push her out.
Oh, that'd be terrible. What a terrible way to end this, you know, hashtag compassionate Cass season.
On the flip side, as far as Abby Maria is concerned, and I only keep bringing her up because, you know, she's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Taking her out of the relative security of Angkor and putting her back in with other people, she's a obvious target.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think she's definitely, you know, again, assuming that things are going to shake up soon, Abby's a target for sure, just because there's going to be people who aren't going to be around that. And I also think we're getting to the point where, depending on the makeup, you're going to start to want getting rid of threats.
Yep. The closer you get to the merge, the less important it becomes to worry about the strength of your tribe.
This is the time of the game where Joe is at his most vulnerable.
Yep. But he's sitting pretty. Literally and in the context of the game.
Very literally, very pretty.
Very pretty. I would not complain if I either was his friend or looked like him or got to hang out with him or took him after whatever it is.
Just saw him one time.
Yeah, like, you, sir, are one of three people alive that pull off the man bun.
So it'll be interesting. I hope they shake it up.
And, yeah, I have a feeling they're gonna.
Okay. Well, we will see what happens, and we'll be back next week to go over everything. Survivor Second Chance, episode 6. Until then, I am John Gilpatrick. You can follow me on Twitter at John L. Gilpatrick.
And I am Maxwell Haddad. You can follow me on Twitter at Cinemaxwell.
And we will talk to you again soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.